Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 328, and it's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support, and if you're listening and would like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is James Stacey, and I'm joined as ever by my illustrious co-host and friend, Jason Heaton. Jason, how are we doing?
I'm doing pretty well. The energy's a little weird because we're recording kind of late in the evening here for various reasons, but otherwise doing fine. The week is short. I'm headed off to Scotland on Thursday night, so I've been kind of doing the usual trip prep of packing and buttoning up the house and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But doing well, and the weather doesn't hurt. It's been downright summery here. How about where you are? Is it warmed up?
It's finally warmed up. Yeah, we're kicking off most days in the teens to the high teens for Celsius. We are recording in the evening, which is might bring a strange energy. The work week has been way too much the last like 6-7 days. So I couldn't take the time out this morning for our normal sort of chill recording time. So we've gone with an evening recording. It's not quite, I mean, it's like 6 o'clock, so it's not TGN after dark or anything like that, but who knows? We might get a little crazy here. We'll see. But with the nicer weather, I have been taking, you know, little breaks during the day or on Sunday, I had a little bit of time just to try and do a little bit of work on the Jeep. Maybe I was a little inspired by the previous episode and your chat about fixing things on the Land Rover and that sort of thing. So as of today, I'm on my, one, two, three, third or fourth set of turn signals for the front of the Jeep. You know, I started out with the stock ones. Then I did an LED upgrade. So you have to put in like a resistive, a resistor to make the flashing set work for the LEDs.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And then that worked fine for quite some time and then failed. And I couldn't find the problem. Turned out to be the actual like light unit. Like the original light unit, somehow I think one of the welds broke, the little tiny like micro welds broke on it, or it broke when I removed it. I'm not sure. So I put on some like Amazon or eBay ones, which were quick and easy. And this is where you get into like the fully closed unit. So there's no installing a splice in resistor or anything like that.
Yeah.
You just connect it with the normal leads for the turn signal. And that didn't last very long. Turns out just poorly made. When I took it apart today, they both of them did not come off of the Jeep without falling apart.
Oh, jeez.
But I did finally break down. I bought kind of the best ones I could find. I didn't really want to go stock, cause I wanted LED. But I bought the JW speakers, which is probably what I should have done several years ago. JW speakers is a maker of fairly high end, kind of considered OEM plus, Jeep gear. I mean, I'm sure they make for other stuff, but they're well known for Jeeps. If you want to spend $700 on your LED headlights, that's a JW speaker. But they have stuff like heating, so snow doesn't build up on the LED, oh, wow. Which doesn't create enough light on its own, or enough heat on its own to melt snow. So, they make a nice product. Huh. I got lucky, found a set of the turn signals on sale, and snapped them up, and they went in today in about 4 minutes. Like I thought I was just barely going to make it between the end of a meeting I had and then this recording and went out and they went in very, very quickly. So then I fixed two or three other things and started pulling a dent out of the bumper as well, just by hand. I think I might have to like find a big tree and a ratchet strap and just kind of use the vehicle's weight to pull the rest of it out. But I will say, if you're the type that occasionally, and I'm not looking for it to be perfect, I know it won't be perfect, all that kind of stuff, but I have some paint repair to do on the side of the vehicle.
Yeah.
Some rust that I've cleaned up and primered, and now it needs a coat of paint. So if you have a great guide on YouTube for how to do some, let's call it 6 or 7 out of 10 paint work. This can be 20-20, you know, 20 miles an hour, 20 feet away. Mm-hmm. Not a big deal. I just want to cover up the what looks like Bondo, but it's actually just primer at this point. So if you have a great guide, drop me it in Slack. I would love a quick and easy sort of, these are the 5 steps and things you should have if you're going to paint something in a field at your cottage or whatever, which is what we're going to try and do.
Yeah, I'd be interested in that too, actually. I've got a fittingly DIY car-related final note today too, just to give a little preview of later. Yeah, I think you'll enjoy that.
Oh, nice. Okay. How about you? You're pretty close to the trip, right?
Yeah. We leave on Thursday night, get there Friday afternoon, and then Saturday morning, taking a rental Defender and driving to the island of Harris, which is a ferry ride across from the Isle of Skye in the Inner Hebrides, and working with a watch brand over there to do something interesting, an interesting project. I'm probably not really at liberty to talk too much about, but it should be fun. And what's really cool is it incorporates a TGN listener who's helping out with the project, and a past guest of TGN will be kind of overseeing the whole thing as well. So really excited. We'll be, you know, driving a Defender. My girlfriend's coming along, doing some hiking, doing some open water swimming, some free diving, some whiskey drinking. Should be great. We'll be, you know, in the islands for 6 or 7 days, and then there's some transit time back to Glasgow and then home. But I did want to mention, you know, some people asked if I'd be doing a meetup at all in Glasgow, and I kind of vacillated on that idea just because we're not there very, very long, just really a night at the beginning and a night at the end. But I think I can swing it on the night of the 17th, something real, really casual. You know, nothing formal, nothing you have to RSVP for, or, you know, don't expect, you know, loads of swag. I might bring a pack of stickers along or something.
Some stickers.
So we found a place at the Templeton Business Center, and it's called West Beer, and they have a beer hall, and it looks great. They brew their own beer right there in Glasgow, and they've got a pretty big space, and it looks pretty great. It's actually in the same building that Honor Dane has their workshops, so pretty cool. And targeting the night of the 17th, I haven't chosen a time yet because we'll be taking a train back from Inverness where we're dropping the Defender off earlier that day, which is like a 3.5 hour train ride. So I'm tentatively saying, you know, 7 PM thereabouts, but just keep an eye on the Slack and the meetups channel, as well as on my Instagram stories. I will, you know, make mention as we get closer to that date, what will work out. So hope to see a few people there. We had a nice meetup in Glasgow a couple of years ago when I was over in Scotland, and that was a bit more of a formal event. But yeah, this one, hopefully I can meet a few folks. Yeah. So looking forward to it.
I've kind of two thoughts. First is something I could Google, but I'll just ask, is Harris the island where the tweed is made?
It is, yeah. And there's a distillery.
Oh, so, very cool.
Yeah, and okay. And ooh, technically, I think
what more does one need?
I think it's actually tweed and scotch. Yeah,
tweed and scotch. Let's go. We'll look good for a few days.
And if you look at any Google images of technically, I think the island is called Lewis and Harris, but I'm just going to call it Harris, and because it's known better by that name. And if you look at any Google images, it looks like they've got these amazing beaches that look downright Caribbean, like that beautiful light blue water with a crescent shaped sand beach. I mean, it looks pretty amazing, and the weather is looking promising as well. So I'm really excited to get over there and
nice.
Check it out. Yeah.
I think I once had a watch strap made out of Harris tweed.
That sounds about right.
But it might've been,
you know, who made that?
Like it might've been for a Schofield.
Yes, it was Schofield. I remember that. I think I tried a few of their straps out as well. I don't know if, you know, it was kind of a campaign that Giles Ellis, founder of the company, was doing, kind of sending straps around, because he was kind of doing that for a while, and I think he still sells some of the straps, but he also had one that was red leather out of the leather from a cricket ball, which I thought was
really
cool.
That
the
was
white
a good
stitching
one. That yeah, was a cool it was super one rigid like yeah. One that broken in, that one might have been pretty good. I didn't have the watches long enough to break one
yeah
in.
Yeah
very very cool stuff. And then the other one is just a note, in the future, if you and I are ever lucky enough to have like Anne Ordain a workshop, a headquarters, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Let's not have it in the same building as a brewery. Otherwise, there's no reason to have an office.
Yeah, right, right.
Well, man, I hope you have an awesome trip.
Yeah. And I guess the bit of news on that front is I will not be here next week. So you've got something cooked up for an episode next week that remains to be kind of determined.
Yeah, I don't want to commit. There's a chance there won't be an episode next week. You know, apologies, but I'm working on 2 or 3 interesting sort of conversations that would be a sort of change of pace from what we've been up to recently. So if any of those pay off, there'll be a normal episode next week, but there's a slight chance there won't be, at which point I apologize, and we may even do something in the future to make up for it, maybe an extra long episode next time or something like that. But I'm doing my best to still have an episode. It'll just be a very different sort of episode, as Jason won't be on.
Yeah. Well, I've got I've got a Facebook Marketplace door to go look at after this, so we should probably blitz through wrist check and jump into our main topic, which is a fun one, as usual. What do you have on?
I'll be quick because I'm not ready to give a full review, but I will have one for Hodinkee and probably for the show. But since we recorded the last show, I'd say the watch I've been wearing the most is the Titanium Seaforth. So I sized the bracelet, and it's really good. The lume dial's rad. The coloring's really nice. I love the black bezel insert. The idea of having a Seaforth, a watch I've owned so many of and have reviewed and enjoyed and really love and appreciate the watch, but to have one in titanium, which has really become kind of my daily wear preference. I don't mind. I definitely don't mind a steel watch 40 mils or less, but if we're going over 40, it's going to have to be titanium for me, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm super happy with it. It's a really good looking watch. It wears really well. The bracelet's great. It's got kind of the next evolution of the clasp that was on the Universa. So you have the Halios symbol is actually a button. And when you press it, you can micro adjust the strap, the bracelet. It's just a really nice little system. And for this much money, Halios continues to just be at the front runner for, I think, value, coolness, all that kind of stuff. Together. But yeah, I've been switching between this, the Doxa 200T Diving Star, which is just,
yeah,
if it's sunny out, that's the watch I'm grabbing. And then just a ton of the Arkin, which I spoke about on the last episode, the Vancouver speakeasy version, which I really, really like. And I actually absolutely, maybe the hardest I've hit a watch in 2-3 years. I smoked my wrist and the front of the bezel on like a steel bollard while looking one way, talking to my family at the zoo.
Yeah.
You know, it's moving along and just whack. Wow. Like enough that the watch hit my wrist bone and hurt my wrist bone. Like I could feel the pain before I even thought of the watch.
Yeah.
And that little, you know, whatever that's super, the highest grade Cerakote, it has the tiniest little hairline scratch. I mean, it was hard enough that if it was a watch with a conventional bezel, the bezel would have certainly come off.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So kudos on that front. But yeah, long way of saying I'm wearing and really enjoying the Lume Dial 4th Gen Seaforth in titanium. How about you?
I have the crew watch number one, the CWC, our TGN watch. I've got it on the rubber NATO, kind of an olive drab rubber NATO. And this watch will be accompanying me to Scotland, fittingly, I guess, back to the UK for it. And be on my wrist for, you know, a good part of the trip, but I'll be wearing something else for part of it as well. But
cool. All right.
Yeah.
Well, look, it's time for the main part of the episode. Obviously, if you've been listening at all this year, this is actually part three of what we call the Q&A. I'm going to keep this intro very straightforward. Normally, our Q&As are recorded audio that's emailed to us, and we cut it into a show, and we put out those roughly once a month. We do 12 a year. We thought we'd flip that on its head to try and capture the vibe of the Slack and have the Slack crew just do text questions. So once a year, we open a thread, we get 60, 70, something like that, questions, and we go through them. So this is them. We've done two of them already. You can find parts one and parts two for the Slack crew and A in the show notes for this episode if you'd like to go back and start at the top if you haven't gotten to them. Otherwise, we're going to start it off with a question from Matt P., who has it's sort of about watch media disappointments or like media covering disappointments in watches. So he said, this might have been covered in the past, but one thing I feel is rarely covered in watch media is disappointments. I'm wondering if you can speak on watches that you may have been really excited about, maybe even planned on purchasing, but when you got hands-on, that really fell flat and you kind of totally changed your opinion. Might also be a watch that you purchased but turned around and sold a short time later. Thanks. Look, thank you so much for that question, Matt. That's a good one. You know, I think we've had a version of this question a few times. And I think, you know, maybe less to the point of Matt's actual question, but like the idea of watch media covering a disappointment, I just don't know that they would unless the disappointment was entertaining in some way. Otherwise, typically, like I don't spend any time thinking about watches that I don't get excited about.
Yeah.
and certainly not those that disappoint me. But I can see your point. And Jason, does anything kind of leap to mind for you for watches that maybe you had a whole bunch of ideas as to what it would be and then you got it in person and it wasn't or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, over the years, you know, I think I used to get the question when I was writing for Gear Patrol, mostly back in the early days. It was like, well, do you ever write a negative review? And it wasn't so much that, you know, I think people's kind of knee-jerk cynical reaction was, well, you're sucking up to the brands or, you know, the advertisers or whatever. But the fact was, my response was always, I just don't like to write about stuff I don't like. And also in the watch world, you know, I have a very specific kind of wheelhouse for what I review, and there just aren't a lot of really bad watches these days. But when it comes to disappointments, there is one that leaps to mind. It's actually the only one I could really think of that I was really, truly excited about. Paid for the pre-order, waited for it to come, and when I got it, I immediately didn't like it. And that is the Momentum, the UDT, that came out last year. We both were excited about it, and you've had a different take on it. You still own yours and wear it. It just didn't do it for me. There was something about the handset that just didn't feel it. Just, I think I had this vision of it being closer to the original, and it wasn't quite. And so maybe my love for the original was just so deep that it just could never measure up. And I flipped it almost immediately. So that's the one that comes to mind.
Yeah. I do like that watch in a vacuum, but if you compare it to a standard UDT, which is a significantly more expensive watch now and probably less quality in many ways, you know, a brand new movement and all this other stuff. For me, the UDT, like as soon as I go into like a smaller watch season, the UDT feels quite large.
Yeah.
In my mind, it actually wears similarly to, or maybe even might actually feel larger. I understand this sounds crazy, but if you have both watches, you might understand. Might actually wear larger than the Aqualand.
Yeah.
Just in all, I don't know what that, you know, we'd have to measure it, or I haven't really like come to any major, but I do like the watch. And I think largely, I think the value of the watch is that what you're getting for the price.
Mm-hmm.
But if it doesn't fit your wrist, it wears kind of like a 007, like an SKX.
Yeah.
It's kind of large. The hands don't bother me. The polished finish on them, I think we could have gone a different way, but I don't disagree that I think if they go through a few versions of this watch, the next one down the line, if they eventually can get to the point of being closer to the original and then have like a little lineup of watches, I think that could work.
Sure.
But for me, I don't, have you found, I guess maybe not, because you're still wearing a ton of the Pelagos FXD. I think I might have been kind of ruined in some, especially if it's not summer, if it's not warm weather.
Yeah.
For watches over 40 millimeters. Like, it's not that, it's not intentional. It's like, I'm realizing it as we're talking about this question, but like, I'm definitely gravitating to like 40 or smaller.
Yeah.
Pretty much all year. And then summer comes around and I'll take the UDT out. I'll take the Aqualand out. I'll, you know, I'll, like whatever the big, fun, cool, big Garmin, whatever it may be, like suddenly makes more sense. But for a good portion of the year, I'm really enjoying like 36 to 40.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's not so much diameter. I do still wear a variety of sizes. It's comfort and weight. And a lot of it does come down to weight. You know, like my JSAR Marathon, like I had that out the other day. It's a tall, heavy watch. My Bremont Supermarine 2000, big, heavy
Very
watch.
Heavy
if I
watch.
Wear that for, you know, for a day, I'm like, okay, I'm going back to, you know, a titanium Pelagos or the CWN1 or a Doxa or something that just...
That's why God made titanium Pro Plofs, right?
Yeah, yes.
But yeah, for me, there's actually several. I distinctly remember two times in my life that I really wanted a Planet Ocean. The first one was a 2500, probably a 2500C. So 2009, 2010, something like that, in 42 millimeters. And I remember seeing somebody else, or no, it was at a store, because this was before I was really part of like hanging out with people about watches.
Yeah.
And it was at a store and I tried it on and like there was no possible way it was going to sit well on my wrist. It was like it wasn't a problem with the watch. Like my wrist did not suit that watch. It sat in a way that kind of activated some of the boniness. And all this, I remember just going like, even when I was holding it in my hands, like the minute the second it was no longer on my wrist, I wanted it again.
Oh yeah.
Just, they're such cool watches. Really, really like the Planet Ocean, but they've never really made one where I was like, I have to have, like it's unavoidable. That's the one.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll get there. And then I remember again, what would have been the last year that, you know, Omega was at Baselworld, 2017, something like that. They came out with the GMT Planet Ocean.
Yeah.
With a black white bezel.
Mm-hmm.
It was very big at 43, but at the time that would have been like in line with the Bremonts I was buying and that sort of thing. but it was like, I don't want to be unfair to Omega, 16, 17-ish millimeters thick.
Yeah.
And like the speed at which I went from being like 9 out of 10 excited, thinking like, oh, if I sell everything, wait for sale, buy secondhand, maybe I could get one of these, like a cool one watch.
Yeah.
Beautifully made. One of the best brands in the world. Top quality. Great movement. Put it on my wrist. I was like, nope, don't want it. Don't care. All good. Didn't want it at all. You know, a GMT diver over much over 14 is kind of thick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
And it all depends. If it's your summer, like if it's a summer move, that's cool. But a you know, $10,000 GMT from Omega is not a summer move. I need to wear that. I need to get my dollars out of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then maybe this isn't quite to like the point of Matt's question, but like we talked about on multiple recent Q&As, I'm very excited about anything that Tudor makes, but I really now keep my excitement until I get to see it in person and try it on my wrist. Cause I would have bought an FXD if they were a little shorter lug to lug. I would have bought a standard Pelagos, a 500 meter Pelagos, if it was slightly smaller, especially lug to lug, like under 50.
Yeah.
If it was 48 or 49 millimeters, it would just fit my wrist so much nicer. And that's, of course, what we get with the Pelagos 39. And then, you know, there's like little tiny things. The Pro is a little thick on my wrist, so it sits up kind of high. And for a daily watch, especially one that conceivably would heavily overlap with the Explorer 2, why bother? So it's a little stuff like that. So
yeah.
I think that probably gives Matt the answer he was looking for, but it definitely happens. But for me, it's less about the way I feel about a watch that's new and coming out. It's when the watch has managed to like wiggle into my brain and become something that like I might actually want. And then you have to go see it in person.
Yeah. And for you, it sounds like it comes down to size. And in all the cases you mentioned, it's...
Yeah, size or like, you know, I don't like gilt, so that's enough. Oh, but sure. I would know that before I got to the watch. You know, it's just, it's like coming across an incredible...
Yeah,
find at a thrift store and it's not the right size, right? Nothing wrong with the product. It's just like it's the wrong size for me. But thank you so much for that question, Matt. And Jason, you want to give this one from Jason a read?
Sure thing. Jason Surma has a three-part elevator pitch question. Give us an elevator pitch to convert the cell phones tell the time crowd to a wristwatch. Give us an elevator pitch to convert the quartz watches or better than mechanical watches crowd to mechanical watches. And give us an elevator pitch to convert a Submariner does the same thing as my SKX 007 crowd to Rolex or other luxury watch brands.
All right, let's go back and forth for each one of these.
Good idea. Yeah. How about the convert the cell phones tell time crowd to a wristwatch?
I mean, it's an elevator pitch, which I feel like Jason is really telling me, James, you don't have 4 minutes for each one of these. So we're going to, I've really attempted to script this out because I'm not known for my brevity. So for the cell phone one, it's a little tough, but if somebody were interested, if they asked or if the conversation came up, I'd say, look, I mean, the thing to keep in mind is like we are in a post sort of style or personality era of cell phones, like mobile phones, the smartphones, they all look the same. Doesn't even matter if Apple made them or Samsung or a brand you've never heard of. They're all just kind of rectangles that you have in your hand. They're also, not always, but they're not really glanceable, and they don't offer any ability for you to like express yourself. Oh, sure, you could put a colorful case on them or whatever, but you still have to take it out of your pocket, light up the screen, and then you have to accept the distractions of looking at the screen, like whatever notifications you may have or that sort of thing. So in a world where we're all on our phones too much or looking at screens too much, and I'm, of course, paraphrasing or generalizing here, but in a world where we're all doing that too much, a watch is good for your mental health. You can only know the time from your watch. And I think it allows you to disconnect a little bit from the phone and certainly disconnect the idea of like what's next or what time is it from the phone. And I think there's some value in that.
For this one, I think I was the most comfortable doing an elevator pitch. I think for the other two, when we get to them, I'll explain further. But I can't really in good conscience do any of these because I feel like unless someone comes to me with an interest in watches, I don't feel like I need to convince somebody to develop an interest in them. But with this one, I think this is the easiest one to kind of wax poetic about. And I do fairly often because I do get people that approach me and say, you know, what is it about watches? Like your phone tells the time or you know, why do you
it's
like them so
like
much?
An uncle,
for me, I
cousin.
Yeah. I you know, go to a dinner party and people say, what do you do? And I do this. And they're like, well, what is it about watches? So I always just say, like, watches are the most durable, timeless, and truly fantastic man-made objects, I think, almost in history. I really can't think of, you know, you could say the automobile, the airplane, the personal computer, et cetera. But those are all great, but they're fleeting and they become obsolete and they disappear. They you know, fall apart or they rust or whatever. And watches can be worn. They're the one object, the one man-made object that can be worn 24/7 for generation after generation, as long as you keep them well-maintained, as well as being functional. So they're not just a bauble. They're not just something you wear to symbolize something or show your wealth. I mean, you can actually use them to, as you just described, to tell the time. They, for the most part, like, okay, we're not talking investment grade stuff, but they retain value. So like you can, you know, if not monetary value, intrinsic value or sentimental value, and they collect memories. And then there's this, also there's this blend of ingenuity and engineering and artistry that you just don't find in very many other things. And I think that you combine all of that and combine it with what you said about like having to even to turn a screen on to check the time at 3 a.m, you're going to sear your retinas and wake yourself up, or
That too, for sure,
you know, like or distract yourself by, you know, pulling it out of your pocket and looking at it, etc. And I just think for all those reasons, a watch is a very compelling choice over a cell phone for telling the time.
If you'll allow me to drag this out even just for another, just with a question, like, do you hear this as often as you did a decade or 15 years ago?
No, I don't.
I don't either. And I think it's because everybody puts their phone in their pocket. Whereas like for years, and those of you in the audience who are significantly younger than Jason and I maybe won't remember this, but there was an era where you wore your belt like, or you wore your phone on your belt.
Oh boy, yeah.
Or like you had a pager and you might glance at the pager and you'd get it just like you would from a Timex, right? You'd get the digital time, no distractions, no telling you had a notification because the phone didn't have notifications. It had calls, it had texts. That's it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I think we got to a point where we started putting these things into our pocket and you had to negotiate with the UI every time you wanted to check the time. Mm-hmm. And like, sure, I'll leave, like even right now, my phone, I have my Helios on, but my phone is next to my keypad, but it's off.
Yeah.
Especially for me, because I switched to Apple several years ago. I started on BlackBerry, went to Apple, came to Android, then back to Apple. And with Android, you know, Samsung had these always on screens.
Yeah.
So the time was glanceable. If you put your phone down on a coffee table or whatever, you could look over and get it.
Yeah.
But now I have that all shut off. I don't want my phone to bother me unless I want something from it. And that's where I think we get the glanceable information becomes the secret sauce of it. But we've dragged this out a little bit too long, like I said I would. So next up, you have a few seconds to do your pitch for quartz watches that are better than mechanical watches. Convince that crowd to switch. To be fair, I'm not sure that they're wrong.
Yeah, my response is I have equal love for quartz. I get the love of mechanical watches, but I'll never try to convert someone. In fact, I often find myself doing the opposite. And I think a lot of people will, especially kind of casual watch people. I'm just happy to see watches on people's wrists, for one thing. So
totally.
I was at a dinner party the other day, asked somebody, you know, they were asking me about a watch. I said, well, I'm happy to see you wearing a watch. What is it? And she got kind of sheepish and sort of was like, oh, it's just this Timex that I press a button and it lights up and I'd like to be able to see it in the dark.
Perfect.
And I was like, that is great. There's nothing to be ashamed of. Like you're wearing a watch. Quartz watches are great. They're durable. They do a lot and they're always ready when you are. So, you know, sorry, you know, Jason, I won't do it. I can't convert somebody, from quartz to mechanical. I think, you know, my earlier response about why watches are cooler than checking the time on your phone applies here in terms of the artistry and the engineering, et cetera, about watches, but I love quartz equally.
Yeah. I would say that my evangelical element of watches is convincing people who only want to use mechanical watches that they should have a quartz watch in their life.
Yeah.
Whether it's a Timex Ironman 8 lap or a great CWC, just something that's accurate and fuss free and you pick it up and you go. And I guess we can flip that on its head and say, like, if I had to, you know, if I was given this side of the debate, to argue in pro of mechanical, which I am, but it's very much a blended. I like both, and I kind of like them equally as long as it makes sense to the watch and the price and the need and the rest of it. But look, if you just want to convince somebody that they might want to consider mechanical watch, we all like a microwave when it's convenient. and if you need the if the convenience is more important than the quality of the food, absolutely, microwave, good choice. But do you want to cook every single meal in the microwave?
Right.
It's kind of the best I could come up with.
That's a good
analogy.
That was
the best Don Draper I've got for anti-quartz sort of sales pitches.
I like it.
To be clear, I don't even own a microwave. I don't like them. So it's a bad metric.
Yeah,
it's really not that hard to make popcorn any other way. And I don't like microwaves, but all right. So we've got the last one, which is my Submariner does the same thing as an SKX. How would you convince somebody that they might want to consider going for the Rolex? I feel like we may land in the same place here.
Yeah, I mean, I can't do it. I won't try to convince somebody because it's funny because way back, I mean, this is before I started writing about watches professionally or anything. I was new to watches. I had gotten that first Planet Ocean that I've talked so much about. But then at some point, I sort of did things in reverse. I mean, I had my Seiko back in high school that I've talked about. But my first real cool watch was this Planet Ocean that I did my dive training in, etc. And then as I dipped into the forums, I started to realize like, whoa, these Seikos are really cool. And they kind of remind me of my old one. So I bought an SKX and I had this revelation that this watch is in-house from top to bottom. You know, Seiko does everything vertically integrated. It's you know, deep diving watch, you know, for whatever you're using it for the average diver person, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember writing this post on Watch You Seek saying exactly this: a Seiko 007 is very similar or does the same thing as my Planet Ocean. And boy, did I get shelled. I got so raked over by the enthusiasts. And of course, now I get it. I understand the nuance, but I'm not going to try to convince somebody that they should move up the so-called food chain of watches to a luxury level. I think if you want more refinement or brand prestige, or, you know, in some cases accuracy or durability of materials, then certainly, but that isn't always necessarily the name on the dial. You talked about your Helios, and that's a good example, you know, of a watch that swings well above its weight. And if it had a different name on the dial, it might cost three times as much. So, yeah. How about you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree. I don't think I would talk somebody out. Like if somebody says that my SKX does the same thing as a Submariner, what they're saying is this watch fills the exact same shape in my life, the same shaped hole in my life that a Rolex would. And that's better. That's better for you.
Yeah.
It's kind of like making 10 grand or 15 or whatever a Submariner costs right now. It's not a normal amount of money.
Yeah.
I wouldn't talk somebody out of that. It's like kind of a pathology to have a product that is as good as an SKX. Is it that accurate? No, not really. Is the fit and finish perfect? No. But back in the day, you could buy them for $200.
Yeah.
That's not what a Seiko costs anymore, but you know, even if you go to something like, let's swap out SKX for one of the Seiko 5 divers, or even go up to an SPB. Let's call it $1,000. So you're at one-tenth the price of a Rolex. I wouldn't talk somebody out of that. What I would probably do is say like, yeah, I mean, you're probably right. Most of your needs are being covered by the Seiko. If you want to get deeper into watches, go learn about Rolex. Don't buy one.
Yeah.
You can decide if that's something you want to do after learning about them. But they're a fascinating company. They make one of the best products in the world. You definitely don't have to own one. That's fine. It's not like, I don't think that matters. So this is, they make the one of the best products in the world that doesn't need to exist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Nobody needs a watch to, you know, to maintain their day to day, certainly not, at least not in Western society. But go back and listen to the Acquired podcast on Rolex. It's 5 hours of just the coolest story. And by the end of that, I think you'll feel a little bit differently than my Seiko does the same thing.
Yeah.
Whether or not you want to buy one is kind of, I would think, almost inconsequential. They're impossible to buy. They're also, you know, a Veblen goods. So you have to deal with that side of it, all that kind of stuff. But there is a cool story behind everything, and that's part of what the appeal of that brand is, even beyond the quality of the product. So I think that's probably the angle I would take, but that last one, I'm not sure I could talk somebody out of it. If you're happy with the Seiko, just be happy.
Yeah, right.
Some of this is just a complete pathology. You know what I mean?
And save the money. Yeah, right. Like he's...
Yeah, save the money. You know, buy plastic trees or whatever.
Right, yeah.
All right, jumping into the next one from Stephen K. He said, this is a fun one. And again, your boy's going to do his best to be brief. If you were to buy a weekend car, what would it be? And then in brackets, he says two of the craziest words ever. No budget. So to be fair, Jason, I have four answers.
All right. What do they say? Like at congressional hearings, I'm going to defer my time to the gentleman from Toronto or something.
You're gonna give me
I'm not quite going to do that.
Well, but no, but there's a couple that you would want, right?
Yeah. So I already have mine. I think that's the short answer. I mean, my old 76 Land Rover, to me, every time I get in that car, I smile. When I drive it, I don't get people shaking their fists or frowning because there's some rich dude in his fancy car cutting me off in traffic. Kids like it. African and British immigrants, you know, give me thumbs ups because it reminds them of home. You know, it's perfect. It's utilitarian. I don't have to worry about parking at certain places. So it's great. And it was cheap. You know, I bought it for $7,900 on Craigslist and it's taught me how to work on it. So, but if you push me to like pick a different car, it isn't the most expensive car or the most, you know, fancy or fast or coveted car. But the six-cylinder 914 Porsche, I think, would be...
A 914-6 is so fun.
I do love those cars. I've always loved the 914.
What color?
I hadn't considered that. I mean, I think there's a nice red.
Bahama yellow, I think.
Yeah, yellow. A good yellow would be nice. I just love the mid-engine. I love the way they sound. I love the little roof panel that pops out.
They look so weird, too.
They're so weird. It's a Porsche, but it's like...
It's also such a friendly car.
Yeah, we're a family friendly show, so I won't swear, but you know, it's not a jerk car. It's not a, you know, car you're gonna get people thinking you're, you know, someone you aren't or whatever. It's a neat little car. I'm sure it has its own issues, but you know, we're talking no budget, so I'll spend something on the car and I'll save the rest for maintenance and repairs. But yeah, so
that's a great pick.
That's my answer. Yeah, how about you? Go for it.
Mine cascades. I'll try and move quickly. You'll understand from the tone of my voice. So let's start with realistic, no budget. Z3, Z4, I've talked about them before. A base Boxster, I still think an incredible option. Maybe not the first gen, I might go with the second. Miata, everyone I've ever driven, amazing. Jason, you had an NC.
Yeah.
I had an incredible couple of days in an NDRF with the folding roof, the worst one, dynamically. It's a great little car. I also just have a fondness, if it wasn't for the size of me, for things like the Triumph Spitfire. I just love like the idea of a little English take on like a Ferrari is great.
Yeah.
Very exciting, very fun. And if I was like retired at 45, I would buy one and it could become my new job. Next up, we're going no budget with a question mark. Vintage Alpha 1750 GTV in red or green over tan. Absolute dream car. I think these are some of the, like, among the most stylish things ever made, not just cars, but the 1750, really any vintage Alpha would be amazing, but a 1750 specifically, not the 2000.
Gorgeous.
In red or green. And then if you wanted to go, I think, well, maybe not in a similar, you'd be up a little bit, but a Boxster RS.
Mm.
So like a really hot Boxster. If you don't know why that might be interesting, look up Das Cayman on YouTube. Thank me later. Truly insane what these cars are. And I think if you just want to drive them on the weekend and you don't live in a world where all of your buddies are kind of doing the Porsche ladder, oh, I got a GTS, I got a GT3, I got a Touring, I got a, you know, this or that.
Yeah.
If you just want the one that's like probably the car Porsche would make if they reset today, it's that one.
Oh, yeah.
That's a modern 718. It's just rad. Really cool car. And the next we're going to go really no budget. Eagle Mark I, which is essentially an F1 car for the road.
Yeah.
So single seater, open wheel, fully open exhaust manifolds, all that cool stuff. You literally look like a 60s F1 driver.
Yeah, these are cool.
What else would be in that? Oh, like a Superformance GT40.
Oh, yeah.
One of these replica South African GT40s where I could have a car where I sit on the left side and have the, or I could sit on the right side and have a sill shifter.
Yeah.
Which would be sick. Like really cool. That would do it for me for sure. And then the other one would be like a really hot Caterham.
Mm, sure.
So we're into these cars that are good for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Or 2 hours, but you're broken when you get out of them, but your hands are shaking and you've got a smile that won't go away. So like a really hot Caterham would be incredible. And then finally, any aerial with a stick.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So, an Aerial 4, an Atom 4 would be amazing. I believe that's the one with the Honda motor and the Honda 6-speed. So give me the Nomad and I could slam it around at the cottage, the off-road one. I'm in for all that kind of stuff. And then finally, really no budget? Jag D-Type.
Oh, okay.
It's the only answer.
That's a good, yeah.
It's the greatest car.
Yeah.
No, nothing looks that good. Nothing sounds that good.
Yeah.
It's the coolest car ever made.
Yeah.
I think it's the best car.
Yeah.
And like, if you come back and you go, well, James, you know, D's are great, but C's are better, I'll give it to you. A C might be prettier. But there's the difference between pretty and cool.
Yeah.
And I think the D hits both of those harder than the C, but I'm good with either.
Yeah.
C's and D's for sure. Love it.
Park it in the garage, put it away wet, so to speak, on Sunday night. And
$6 million.
Yeah.
or whatever a D-Type costs.
Yeah, right.
The thing with D-Types is most of them have race provenance, so the pricing can be something else.
Yeah.
Anyways, really fun question, Steven. I know people get tired of me rambling on about cars, but yeah, I gave you four different levels there and about 10 different cars, but I could have a good time.
All right, I got time for one more.
Let's do one more.
Yeah, let's do one more from Andrew L. He's got a fun one. It's not watch related. It's not car related. You're hosting a dinner party. The goal is to share some of your favorite things with the people that are closest to you. What does the menu look like? What is the appetizer, the main course, the dessert, and one signature cocktail or drink you will serve, and the setting? So he gives an example: fresh veggies and homemade black bean hummus, a Neapolitan pizza, ladyfinger fruit parfait, and his drink is a mezcal old fashioned, and he's doing it at the end of summer at Rosemary Beach on a rooftop terrace. James, what's your take on this one?
We'd be at my cottage. Yeah, just have a big crew, probably a lot of people making different foods. But for me, appetizers would be oysters and shrimp cocktail. That's my favorite food and Sarah's favorite food. Main, with the exception of whatever it was I was cooking for Jason, the core meal would be steak frites, which would be probably my last meal.
I'd eat that.
If I had to pick a last one.
Yeah.
But I make a very mean steak, and my brother makes really incredible French fries, and you put those together, and I need it with the herb butter. Like, if I'm going to do steak frites, I want to feel it. I want to go like full Orson Welles. and like really, really enjoy it. I don't want casual steak frites.
Yeah.
Dessert. I'm not really a dessert guy, but a couple times a year I'll go for apple pie. And my mom makes apple pie with an apple crisp top. So it's like extra desserty.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's some alchemy, some magic that my mom has figured out, some dark magic she's tapped into in the apple world. Really good. And then as far as the drink, I would say you'd have two options. The first would be just a really good bourbon.
Yeah.
Just to have around is nice. And then the gin cucumber drink that we talked about in the past. Which, if you didn't catch that episode, it's soda, not tonic, mulled cucumber, so cucumber all crushed up in the bottom of the glass, and then it's a gin of your choice. I'm partial to Monkey, or Botanist is okay, like that kind of stuff. And then black pepper to finish over ice, and it's just very refreshing and light, and has that sort of cucumbery black pepper cleanness to it. And then with the gin, adding a little bit of the floral piney element, it's really nice. But that would be my sort of short menu for the night.
Yeah, sounds terrific. And you know what I love about this is Andrew's and yours and now mine. We're coming into summer here, right? I mean, the weather feels very summery, and it's exactly the vibe I'm going for. I mean, I can do a nice dinner inside by the fire, but my brain is already leaping ahead to summer. And so for me, I'm just doing it on my back patio. I've got a little pergola here and kind of sit around on some patio furniture, keep it casual. Late summer, so less bugs. You know, the mosquitoes are kind of a little bit less.
Nice.
Kind of my setting. Appetizers, I'm doing like an olive tapenade, you know, like an olive spread that you can put on like crostini. And
sounds good. I should have had olives in mind.
To be clear, I'm... You can add that in.
Olives are so good.
We'll give that to you. Yeah, I love olives. I just love olives. To be clear, my plan is we're doing it on the patio. So I've got that snow peak fire pit that you gave me that folds up. Mm-hmm. Like you can deploy it and you can build like a little wood fire, and it's got a grate that you put over the top to cook on. I use that a lot in the summer. So I'm grilling crostini. I'm taking like some slices of like baguette and brushing it with olive oil and putting it on the fire till it gets kind of crisp and blackened. And then you're spreading olive tapenade on that. Maybe a bowl of some spicy nuts or kind of those curried dried peas you can get. And then for those that like a good hard cheese, like a Manchego or a Gouda or something, I'll have a little plate of that with like some sliced pear.
Well, you're
or
eating
apples.
Cheese these days?
No, I'm doing it for my guests. I'll put it out for the guests.
I love cheese. I'll live at that table for sure.
And then if you still have an appetite after all this, because I've got the grill going, I'm gonna do like a maple marinated grilled salmon. You know, salmon fillets, like get it really hot and like so that the skin is really crispy and blackened. And then I'm also going to do slices of grilled bell pepper. And then I'll serve that with like some spaghetti that I've tossed with some freshly made pesto. So that's the main. And then dessert, you know, I made something recently. It was like a lemon olive oil cake, which was a very simple thing, and it was good. Really good.
And not too sweet.
Not too sweet. I think it was a kind of a good way to finish. And then for drink, I'm going with a gin drink as well. And you mentioned I'd forgotten about Botanist Gin, but I really like Botanist Gin, and it's from Scotland. So I think that's fitting for today since I'm leaving for Scotland. I'm just going to do a gin and tonic. So with lime wedges. So there you have it. Just a summer meal.
And if we were doing this at like two different stations at the same party, I could bring an oyster or two over to the grill.
Yes.
Cook them
up.
That's what that little snow peak, there's a guy that I follow on Instagram, and he hikes somewhere and then cooks a little meal.
Yeah.
And he has like a mini version of the snow peak that can also like heat up sake.
Oh.
Has like a little port for it. And he'll do like two big oysters and some veggies. And then once the grill's fully up to temperature, he'll cook a little piece of meat or whatever it is. It's great. I'll send you the next one. The next time that the algorithm gives me one of his. But yeah, that's a fun question, Andrew. And now I'm starving.
I am too.
Man, all that sounds so good.
Yeah,
that's great. Well, that gives me. I now have several ideas for our pre-Toronto Timepiece Show dinner.
Yeah,
which we did last year and we'll do again this year. Yeah, we can definitely do a bunch of this. But yeah, we have run out of time for questions, more of these questions. So we've got tons of leftover for future outings of the Slack crew and A. You want to jump into some final notes quick and get you on your way for your Facebook Marketplace purchase?
Sure thing, yeah. We talked a lot about cars today and car DIY repairs at the top. And I recently came across this YouTube personality who's got a fairly big following and some really great videos. And the one I watched was just fantastic. It's called The Long Way Home. The guy's name is Simon Fordman. It's from April of 2024. And it's basically just him fixing up an old Chevy C10. So this is like a rusted out old Chevy pickup truck that he purchases in Jackson, Wyoming. And he's going to drive it, he says, about 1,000 miles home. The video starts about 15 miles from where I purchased the truck in Ashton, Idaho, and where I pulled off to start a few repairs. And it's an hour long, and it's great. And I didn't realize till I just looked at the bottom of the notes, but his home is in Minnesota. So fitting. This guy's
get him
great.
On the show.
It is really, there's no voiceover. It's just, it's very ASMR, very like just meditative. Mm-hmm. You can just watch and do something else while you're watching it. A lot of kind of old truck sounds and lots of repairs and camera angles and lots of rust and stuck bolts and stuff like that. It's a real pleasure to watch. I just really, really enjoyed this one. And, you know, it's gotten 1.7 million views. So chances are a lot of you have seen this already, but if not, you're in for a treat. So check that out.
Also like the like lead image when you click in, is a shot of the truck, the rear three quarter. There is not one straight panel on that truck. The bumper goes in four different directions. There's like a very solid like ripple along the top of the bed. I love it. I really genuinely adore a vehicle that has been like lived, like the Jeep has dents and the rest, like it's great.
Yeah,
and this is killer. So you sent this to me last week and it's really good.
His whole channel looks promising, but that one in particular.
I have subscribed. And Simon, if you'd like to come on the show, let us know. We'd love to chat with you about making videos about your C10.
Yeah.
And mine this week is actually just something that has kind of been on my buy list for 4 or 5 years. And as I'm planning, you know, just getting a few things together for going up to the cottage and really starting that season, I did want to go with a fixed blade knife.
Oh, yeah.
And I looked at all the giant mouse stuff. And look, let's be clear. I'll probably still go that way eventually. But I wanted to start with something much more basic, something that I didn't really mind handing to one of my kids or for my wife to use while gardening and that sort of stuff, or even, you know, like harder tasks around the property. And there's pretty much one knife, and knife guys already know exactly where I'm going with this. I haven't owned one of these in about a decade, but I bought a Morinev Companion, which is like a $20 fixed blade knife from Sweden. And it's just awesome.
Huh.
It's simple.
Yeah.
It's the Series 1 Land Rover Defender of straight fixed knives.
Yeah.
This knife can't offend anybody. It doesn't, it's not really scary. It's not like an 8-inch Rambo.
Yeah.
It's like 4-ish inches. It has a nice plastic sheath that you can just drop over a belt. And it comes super sharp, made out of very simple steel. Again, we're talking about a $20 knife. Check it out. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I hadn't had one of the Morinev products in a very long time. When I first moved to Vancouver in 2012, I had one. And then I quickly switched it out for, I don't know why, probably because I have some sort of, you know, sickness. But I bought a Glock Model 78, which is like a military bayonet style fixed blade.
Yeah.
The Glock is a cooler, kind of more tactical knife. The Morinev is a significantly nicer knife to actually use and cut and do anything with. I think these should be like in everyone's trunk or, you know, in your gardening kit or whatever. They're just really handy. They're the right size. They have a great ergonomic handle and a very simple plastic sheath. So you don't, like, if you put this on your belt and then just happen to go to the garage or go to the hardware store or Home Depot later,
oh, sure.
Nobody's going to be like, that guy's walking around with a huge knife.
That's good.
It's just a normal knife.
That's a good thing. Yeah, right.
it's not like grandpa. It's just very like, this is a tool for cutting some stuff on my property.
Yeah.
This is not for brandishing at somebody. This is not the kind of knife you would like. You know, nobody's holding somebody up with a knife like this, but check it out. I'm really, really happy with it.
Yeah, this is
and
cool.
It's the, you know, I, the older I get, the more I like friendly cars and friendly knives.
Yeah.
Like whether it's a Series 1 Land Rover or a Miata or like a knife where you can't really be a problem because you have it.
Right.
And really, if it's a folding knife, everybody, you're welcome to, you know, let me know what you think. But Jason, my experience with folding knives is like, if it's not a Victorinox, people will go like, why do you have that?
Yeah.
Why do you have that? Why do you carry that weapon around?
Right.
Yeah. And this kind of hits the same like Boy Scout appeal of a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah. I like this. And wait, what a price. Jeez, made in Sweden. This looks great. Yeah.
I don't know how they make any money on this. They must make so many.
Yeah.
You know, and it feels so sturdy. It's not full tang. Again, 17, 18 bucks.
Yeah.
I think the first one I bought at Mech, and it was a weird color, like a tan color, and it was like $12. And I remember the guy telling me, like, this is the knife everybody actually uses after they buy all the expensive stuff for years.
Yeah.
And maybe he was right, maybe he was wrong. I don't know. But I'm super impressed by it, highly recommend it, and I can't wait to put some, you know, dents and scratches in it.
Yeah, I love it. That's nice. I'm going to look for one. That's a great final note. All right.
They make a larger one too if you have like actual cutting to do, like one that you could hit with a hatchet or a hammer to split logs, that sort of thing. They make a bigger one, like a bush knife.
Oh, sure.
But this is just a very simple, you know, smaller fixed blade. It's handy.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. There's an episode. Got to get you on your way.
All right. Well, it was fun. I love these Q&As because, you know, I think at first we thought that these were going to be like quick hit, like we can kind of do quick answers and kind of roll through them. I actually find that some of these they're quite complicated and multi-part, and we can kind of take our time with them. And
we've got the whole year to get through the list.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, all right. Well, as always, thanks so much for listening, and to those of you who submitted questions. We will get to them eventually, probably, you know, some of the latter ones by the end of the year, but if you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly and maybe even grab a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegraynato.com. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we'll leave you with this quote from Albert Einstein, who said, "Don't listen to the person who has the answers. Listen to the person who has the questions."